Fruit Loops episode 11. Thank you so much for listening. Fruit Loops is a podcast about true crimes committed by people of color and their victims that we don't know or hear much about. Contrary to popular belief, not all serial killers are white. There are many well-documented cases of serial killers of color, and Fruit Loops is a podcast all about them. We take deep dives into the fascinating lives and crimes of serial killers and true crimes committed by people of color and their victims that the media and entertainment commonly leave out because, ding, ding, the news is racist.
And we are Wendy and Beth. She's Wendy. I'm Beth. We're not journalists, investigators, or psychologists. Nope. Just a couple of gals interested in true crime.
That's right.
Some of the things that we discuss on this podcast may be triggering and or disturbing to some listeners. In this podcast, we discuss sexual assault, torture, race, and murder. And sometimes we use explicit language. Listener discretion is advised. Also, the opinions expressed in this podcast are just that, our opinions. Please send any questions or comments to fruitloopspod@gmail.com. Enter at your own risk.
So how are you, Beth?
I'm doing much better today than I was yesterday because I was sick yesterday. And so I feel better.
Good.
How are you doing?
Great. I happen to love the Marvel movie comic universe, MCU,
as
it's colloquially known. And I finally saw Avengers Infinity War with my kids. And when I get really excited and I'm watching a movie, I can't sit down. I have to pace. And I was like pacing and like jumping. It was so good. I mean,
it
if you're
really
into
good.
it had everybody. Black Panther was there. Thor was there. Eagle Eye was there. All of them. Spider-Man. Was so, the kid who they have cast as Spider-Man is fucking awesome. He's the best Spider-Man yet. And Mark Ruffalo plays the Hulk, and he is also the best guy to have played the Hulk so far. So
yeah, he's really good.
Yes, he is good.
I'm gonna have to check that out.
You should just get it on demand.
I'm behind on my Avengers. I still have to watch the second one. I watched the first one, but I didn't watch the second one. And this is a third one, right?
Yeah, this is, I think, the third one. And I don't know if you need to watch the second one to see this.
I know, but I'd still like to.
You should watch, however, before you watch this one, Thor Ragnarok.
Okay,
Ragnarok,
I haven't, yeah.
Something like that. it's like what takes place like immediately after that. So,
that's another one I need to watch. See, I watch all the first ones. Like I've seen Thor and I've seen the Avengers. I watch all the first ones and then I just kind of get lost after that. I don't know what happens, but.
Well, next time it's on TV, just sit down.
I'll just sit down and watch it.
Never mind all the other stuff, good. So this next part of our show is our shout out time, and we like to shout out any content by people of color or about people of color or any true crime goodies. So
I wanted to recommend the Criminology Podcast, season 3, episode 4. Okay, so it's about Ted Bundy. I don't know if you've listened to Criminology before.
I have, and I don't Go ahead. The Ted Bundy ones are in my feed, in my queue.
Yeah. Yeah. So they do, every season is a different crime arc. I think the first one was the Zodiac. The second one for sure was the Golden State Killer.
That's right.
And then this one is Ted Bundy. And there's only 4 episodes, so it's pretty short comparatively. Like the Golden State Killer was really long. And so it's pretty easy breezy listen. But episode 4, in the latter half of the episode, they talk to a neuroscientist about brains. Serial killer Ooh. Brains and Ted Bundy. And I thought it was fascinating. Yeah, both about Bundy and serial killers in general. So, yeah, I wanted to recommend that because there's a lot of good information in there, I thought.
I will be checking that out. Thanks, Beth.
Sure thing.
All right. Extra, extra, read all about it. Any true crime news? I guess I'll start. Molly Tibbett's body was found, which is good closure for her family, right?
Right.
It looks like she was murdered by stabbings. Her body had evidence of sharp force injuries. An immigrant led the police to her body. His name is Cristian Baena Rivera, a 24-year-old Mexican man who illegally came to the United States. Was charged with her murder on Wednesday after he confessed to following her on her run. In an arrest affidavit, Rivera said he remembered getting mad at her. What happened afterward was blocked from his memory. When he came to, he realized he had put a bleeding Tibbetts in his trunk, and then he carried her to a cornfield and left her there. That's what the affidavit states. After the guy killed her, he continued to show up for work every day for the next almost 30 days as if nothing happened. Wow. The loss of this young woman, that's wild. Yeah, the loss of this young woman is being overshadowed by the race, color, and immigration status of the killer. And even Molly's family was like, the immigration status doesn't matter. Molly is still gone. Nine, that's how I refer to 45, because you add the 4 and the 5, and then he's 9, is using incendiary language like illegal alien. First of all, people cannot be illegal. They are undocumented. And also, I think this guy, his attorney said he was here legally. So I don't know. All the news is saying that he wasn't legal, or he was.
I guess we'll find out. Yeah,
his attorney says he was. Yeah, so we shall see on that. He is responsible for the terrible murder of Molly Tibbetts, allegedly, since innocent until proven guilty, I guess. And condolences to her family and loved ones.
Yeah, really, really upsets me to see people use his immigration status as a tool to justify this administration's draconian practices at the border, like family separation.
Right.
In my opinion, it boils down to racism. Mm-hmm. Yeah, if this guy's guilty, he did a terrible thing. Mm-hmm. But when a white guy kills someone, say Christopher Watts, who's admitted to killing his pregnant wife and 2 children, babies.
Right.
We don't just automatically jump to the conclusion that all white men need to be banished from the country.
Well,
why is that? Because we know not all white men are the same. Most of them don't kill their families.
What?
Understand that. I know. But a Mexican guy who may have been in the country illegally commits a horrible crime, and suddenly all Mexicans are terrible and it's okay to treat Mexicans like human garbage at the border. It's not okay. No. The administration is using Mexicans as a scapegoat to rile up their base. And, I keep thinking about the Holocaust, I know when people, it gets like, heated. Mm-hmm. People always bring up the Holocaust and Nazis and stuff. But there really is a parallel.
Oh, yes.
The Nazis riled up their base by talking about Jews, mm-hmm. like they were terrible people.
Yeah.
And you're in a terrible administration
because of those people over there. It's those
because of those people. There. Those people are causing your problems. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, it's working.
Yeah.
And it's really sad and distressing to me to see how racist our country can be.
Yeah.
The reality is that unauthorized immigrants commit fewer crimes than native-born residents. And I'll link that in the footnotes.
Thank you.
You're welcome. do we need a secure border? Sure.
Yeah.
But guess what? We already have a pretty secure border.
Mm-hmm.
I know, that's shocking.
Yeah. Guess
given
what? There's
the
already a
fucking
right.
wall. According to a 2017 Homeland Security report, which I will also link in the footnotes, successful border crossings have been going down dramatically for over a decade. Homeland Security's conclusion is that it's more difficult to cross the border now than ever before.
Mm.
Finally, I'm appalled that Molly Tibbetts' murder is being overshadowed by this racist debate about illegal immigration.
Mm-hmm.
A woman was murdered. People are not talking about Molly. They're not even really talking about her alleged murderer, Christian Bahena Rivera.
Mm-hmm.
They're talking about immigration,
right.
Including me now. So I'm going to stop right here.
We're setting the record
And if
straight.
It turns out... Yes, and if it turns out this guy is guilty, like you said, innocent until proven guilty, if it turns out he's guilty, I hope maybe we can do an episode about it.
Yeah.
Once all the facts are out.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Hopefully we will get to the bottom of this. Justice will be served properly and correctly,
mm-hmm.
and then we can talk about it on this show.
Yep.
So, who are we talking about today, Beth?
Today we're talking about Timothy Wilson Spencer, also known as the Southside Strangler. This case is notable as the first case in the U.S. where DNA was used to convict a serial killer. DNA had been used in a previous killer in the U.K. when a man by the name of Colin Pitchfork was convicted of murdering two teenagers. That case is documented in a book called The Blooding by Joseph Wamba, and also there was a recent ITV TV series called Code of a Killer, which is about that case. But it's a bunch of white people, so
we won't be
covering that case.
But is this dude's name really Pitchfork?
Yes,
okay.
Colin Pitchfork.
Okay.
Yeah.
Timothy yep. Wilson Spencer was convicted of raping and strangling four women over 11 weeks in 1987. Very busy. There was very little circumstantial evidence, and Spencer did not confess. Then DNA tests linked semen from the crime scenes with Spencer's blood.
Most of Spencer's victims were killed while he was living at a Richmond halfway house after being released from a state prison, where he had served 3 years of a 10-year sentence for burglary. The slayings took place on weekends when Mr. Spencer was signed out of the halfway house.
Oh,
now for
right.
the stats.
Let's get into some stats. Oh, all right. Mr. Spencer had 5 murder victims, 9 rape victims. His crimes spanned from 1984, and then he took a break. He must have been in prison then. No? Yeah, he was in prison. And then
that was when he was in prison.
1987 to 1988, the crimes occurred in Arlington and Richmond, Virginia, and his AKAs are the Southside Strangler, the Southside Slayer, and the Southside Rapist. I wanted to point out that his method for selecting his victims included stalking, lying in wait, and strangling. And I bring that up because he raped a bunch of people before he started killing people. And there was a woman who her home was broken into, and she found the string for your blinds. They were cut.
The Venetian blinds.
Yeah, and neatly placed on her bed as if he was like waiting for her, but she took too long. So he left, and nothing ever ended up happening to her other than her home being broken into.
Yeah, that's freaky.
So yeah, he would just sit there and wait. Okay. Scary.
Yeah, very scary. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So Timothy Wilson Spencer was born on March 17th, 1962 in Arlington, Virginia. He grew up in the lower-income neighborhood of Green Valley in Arlington, Virginia. His parents had some college and were employed, but at some point they divorced. So he was raised by a single mother, and his youngest brother, Travis, said that they had a very structured family and that their mother was the best mother in the world. Travis also said that Timothy was a loving brother, and he has fond memories of his brother teaching him to ride a bike. Timothy was described as uniquely handsome, mm-hmm. with hazel eyes, but he was quiet. He was intelligent, but was a poor student, and he didn't do well in school. He started getting into trouble around the age of 9, when he often stole things. At 12 years old, he would urinate and defecate in the school's public areas, and had a history with arson. At some point, he even set his mother's car on fire.
What the fuck?
I know. The urinating and defecating. Somebody should have been like, this kid needs a counselor.
We need to add him to the prayer list ASAP. Christ. All right. So Arlington and Richmond, Virginia in the mid-1980s is where this all took place. Arlington is considered a bedroom community and is very close to Washington, D.C. So I listen to a lot of Black people podcasts, and a lot of them are based in what they call the DMV. And I'm like, what is the DMV? It stands for, D.C., Maryland, and Virginia. So this happened in DMV.
It's like a tri-state area.
Yeah, it's just a, they group it all these three different states in one place. So DMV for sure.
DMV, I'm thinking of the motor vehicles.
That's what I was thinking. So I'm like listening to these podcasts like, what the heck? We're on the West Coast, so I have no idea what they're talking about. So I had to go to the source. So I have several cousins who are on the, I have hundreds of cousins, if you haven't figured it out.
So they're in the DMV?
Some of them are in the DMV. They explained to me, so thank you, cousins, for doing that. So Richmond was the formal capital of the Confederacy. Oh, my favorite. And it has a long history of deep racial divisions. Confederate flags were everywhere. As late as 1968, the newspaper Real Estate still divided real estate ads into Black and white homes. Shout out to redlining. Schools didn't desegregate until the 1960s, early 70s. Brown v. Board of Education was in the 50s, you guys. So they were a little late.
Yeah, took them a little while.
The mid-80s saw a burgeoning crack epidemic. The murder rate skyrocketed, and Richmond was starting to be referred to as the murder capital of the South. Ay, Dios mío.
So now we're going to get into the timeline.
Hey.
Yeah. Here we go.
Let's do it.
You ready?
Did you hear the splash? I just dove in.
Just dove into the timeline. Between June 1983 and January 1984, 9 women in Arlington had been attacked by an African-American man in his 20s who carried a knife and wore a makeshift mask. The police call this man the masked rapist. They're very creative.
Very creative with their names. Way to go, law enforcement. Hey, good job, guys. 10 points for creativity.
He told the women he raped that he would kill them or their family if they told anyone what happened. He even stuffed one woman into the trunk of her car and then set the car on fire. She was able to escape by kicking the trunk open. That's pretty fucked up.
Super fucked up. I wish. Okay, so we know he didn't confess and he said very little to explain himself. But I wish he would.
Right,
bro. What's wrong with you?
I know.
So January 25th, 1984, 32-year-old lawyer named Carolyn Hamm was found in her home dead. She had been raped and strangled, and she was found with her hands behind her back, tied up. The perpetrator entered her home through a basement window, and David Vasquez, a Latinx and mentally handicapped McDonald's janitor, was arrested and confessed to the murder. He was convicted and sentenced to 35 years. Now, if you read the transcript of them interrogating him, they were feeding him like all the info, so it was really fucked up with the police. They were like,
yeah,
he was like, okay, I guess I stabbed her, and then they were like, no, you didn't stab
her. Like, no, you didn't stab her.
And he was like, all right, fine.
Oh yeah, I strangled her.
So
I'm laughing, but it's not funny.
It's really not funny. So I don't know. I don't know why this is allowed, but the police can lie to you when they're trying to get information from you, and it just makes me ugh.
What I remember from that Southern Nightmare podcast, he said that they lied to him and they told him that they had his fingerprints. Mm-hmm. They did not have his fingerprints, yeah. But since he only had an IQ of 70.
Yeah.
And he had a mental, capacity of like a 10-year-old.
I heard that too.
And so, yeah.
It was wrong.
So he thinks, well, they have my fingerprints. So he has no idea what to do. Mm-hmm. He's mentally 10 years old, you know?
Yeah. And I wonder, I know.
It's pretty sad.
We can all say, I need a lawyer. But are police obligated to offer that to somebody with a mental deficit?
I don't think so, but I think they should.
All right. So
where
are legislators?
I think as soon as they realize, I think that as soon as they realize this person has a mental handicap, that they should be treated differently.
I think so too.
You know,
I think so.
But
well, if I'm
like children are treated differently.
Beth, only some children are treated differently. and the need for this podcast. Okay.
Yeah. True.
So what's next?
Okay. All right. So on Dinwiddie Street, only two blocks from Ham's house, someone had broken into a residence through a downstairs window and left some cords cut from a Venetian blind on a woman's bed, but the intruder left before the woman returned home. Mm. Around the same time, a woman who lived nearby was assaulted by the masked rapist who had broken in through a window. The similarities in the masked rapist assaults were striking. Starting with the fourth victim, all of the women had been tied up with rope or cords from Venetian blinds. The fifth victim had been locked in the trunk of a car that was subsequently set on fire, but she was able to kick her way out and escape. The last victim, who lived just six blocks away from Carolyn Hamm, had been attacked on January 25th, 6 hours after Hamm's body was discovered.
Shout out to that woman who got away. On January 29th, 1984, 4 days after Carolyn Hamm's body was found, Timothy Wilson Spencer was arrested for a burglary in Alexandria. After serving his time, he was released to a halfway house on Richmond's south side on September 4th, 1987. At the halfway house, he was seen as a loner. He did not engage with other parolees there. The only person he really talked to was a female member of the staff, and he worked on her car for her, and she allowed him to use it. He often took it to go to the Cloverleaf Mall. By the way, I think I heard in the documentary, or not documentary, the 10-episode podcast about this particular murderer, uh-huh. that he had a girlfriend at the time.
Yeah, yeah, I heard that too, but I didn't mention anything about it in here because I didn't really know anything else about that.
Probably not best to dive into it, but I just wanted to shout out that I heard that. So,
yeah. So on September 18th or 19th, between 9 p.m. and 9 a.m., somewhere in there, in 1987, Debbie Dudley Davis was murdered. Debbie Davis was described by her friends as a sweet woman who didn't have an enemy in the world. She was a 35-year-old divorced white woman who worked at Style magazine as an accounts manager. Debbie Davis was thought of at the office as sort of a house mother, a kind woman known for bringing in cookies and decorating for the holidays. She also worked part-time a few nights a week at a bookstore as a sales clerk. The bookstore was at the Cloverleaf Mall. Mm-hmm. She loved popular culture and was even an extra in a movie. So on the night that she was murdered, Spencer cut the screen of her window and climbed in using a rocking chair to stand on. And once he got into her house, he waited for her to come home. He made a homemade tourniquet. Once she came home and he attacked her, mm-hmm. he raped her, and then he choked her using a sock and a vacuum cleaner extension. Mm-hmm. And then he would revive mm-hmm. her. He strangled and tortured her to death. The victim's body was found on her bed by the officers of Richmond Bureau of Police.
So this is one sick fucker. And
yeah, I kind of hate this.
Yeah, I'm grateful that we found the details about how he did it, but it's just so sinister. So I at first
upsetting.
Yeah, yeah. When I so I'm picturing he took the sock and then used like the you know those attachments for vacuum cleaners that nobody ever knows what to do with.
Yeah, that's what
and
it
he
is.
Just, like,
yeah.
He just was turning it.
Turning it to choke her. Yeah.
Oh, goodness gracious. And then I'll also need to mention that Richard Foster, the guy who is responsible for this, the Southern Nightmare podcast. Yes. He worked at this magazine also after Ms. Davis passed away, but
Style magazine.
Yeah, Style magazine. So that's how he was able to interview people who knew her and worked with her there. So the medical examiner determined that the ligature had been twisted 2 or 3 times and the cause of death was ligature strangulation. The pressure exerted was so great that in addition to cutting into Miss Davis's neck muscles, Jesus, larynx and voice box, it had caused blood congestion in her head and a hemorrhage in one of her eyes. In addition, her nose and mouth were bruised. Miss Davis's hands were bound by the use of shoestrings, which were attached to the vacuum cleaner extension. Semen stains were found on the victim's bedclothes. The presence of spermatoza, ooh, fancy word, also was found when rectal and vaginal swabs of the victim were taken. In addition, when the victim's pubic hair was combed, 2 hairs were recovered that did not belong to the victim. The 2 hairs later were determined through forensic analysis to be consistent with Spencer's underarm hair. And further forensic analysis was completed on the semen stains on the victim's bedclothes.
I also heard, and I don't remember where, but the hair evidence, which they used to rely on mm-hmm. Pretty heavily, mm-hmm. Is not as reliable as they used to think it was. So like hair can be consistent with a person, mm-hmm. but it can't really identify
that
a
makes
person.
Sense. That makes sense. And I think that it's cool that we're evolving in terms of how we investigate these crimes.
The science evolves.
The science is evolving. And I think that it's also cool how the, I think if you parallel how science is evolving with how we are evolving as a people, and now we have LGBTQ+, and now we, society is evolving as well as the science that's supporting all the things that we do. So I think that that is a cool little parallel that I had to say something.
Yeah.
So anyway,
it is pretty cool. So on October 2nd, 1987, or on the early morning of October 3rd, 1987, Dr. Susan Helms was murdered. Dr. Helms was a neurosurgery resident. She was described as having the eye of an eagle, the heart of a lion, and the hands of a woman. She was a ferocious reader. The police were called by her husband after he returned home and discovered her partially clothed body on the floor of the couple's bedroom closet. She had been beaten, raped, and strangled. The perpetrator had entered her house by cutting the second story window screen.
Second story. It was surmised he climbed?
Second story. Yeah. I can't remember where it was. I saw it or read it, but he like stood on a fence and like pulled himself up through the window. So, they surmised that he was athletic.
Yeah.
Because of that. So they think that he broke into her home and then hid in her closet and waited for her to come home. They thought that because she had taken off a watch and her earrings and placed them where she normally put them. So she must have been surprised by her killer. And then she was strangled using two belts. There was a red belt around her neck and a black belt connected to it. So the killer could pull it from a distance to torture her, kind of like a dog leash. Mm. The killer also left a tub of Vaseline at the crime scene, but no fingerprints or hairs.
I saw in a documentary, and we can link it to the show notes, it was on YouTube, that both Debbie Davis and Dr. Helms had a connection at a local bookstore at the Cloverleaf Mall, where Spencer hung out. Debbie Davis worked at the bookstore, and Dr. Helms bought books there.
Yeah, I actually saw that.
The surveillance?
Dr. Helms. Dr. Helms had written a check.
Oh, yes.
To the bookstore. Mm-hmm. I saw
that too. So on November 22nd in 1987, Diane Cho, a 15-year-old high school student, was raped and killed. Diane was Korean. She was an immigrant kid. She was a good kid. By the way, I have mentioned that being a person of color is one thing, and then being an immigrant or a child of an immigrant is extra challenging. So I think I saw in the documentary that like she was the one person in her family who spoke the best English. So she had to do a lot of translating for her family.
She was kind of the mom of the family.
Yeah, and she worked.
She was doing things that a mom would do.
Yes.
Registering her brother for school stuff like that.
Her brother, I think, said that she wanted to be a doctor when she grew up. But she was, other than that, a really normal teenager. She would rebel occasionally. She had a boyfriend that her parents didn't know about, and she would smoke cigarettes, now and then.
Yeah.
she told a friend, I think it was her best friend, Jenny, that she was being followed. And it was Spencer. And then next thing you know, Spencer was in her bedroom.
she told her friend that she felt like she was being followed, but she didn't want to tell her parents because her parents were very strict, mm-hmm. Being Korean, and they were very traditional Koreans. Mm-hmm. She was afraid that if she told them about it, that they wouldn't let her go out. So she didn't want to tell them
about
it.
So Spencer got into Diane Cho's bedroom, and he strangled her and he tied her up. Investigators were shocked by Spencer's audacity because she was raped and strangled in her bedroom. He entered through a window, and he never made a noise to wake her parents or her brother, who were in the bedrooms next to her. Spencer left a single hair in Diane Cho's bedsheet, and investigators who previously believed that the killer was white realized that the hair left behind was Negroid hair. And I don't think that term is still PC, but anyway, that's...
Yeah, you know, there's like three different types. There's Caucasian, there's Negroid, and there's Mongoloid. And I think that's really awful.
Oh my God. Awful too. Stop it, guys. Come on.
I know. White people should not be allowed to name hairs.
No. Oh my God. Mongoloid? Okay, I can't.
Mongoloid, yeah.
I can't. That's it. I'm leaving. Goodbye.
I can't even.
All right, my bet. You're talking to my ghost because I'm. This is ridiculous. So, Jesus. Okay, let's all do better. Okay, let's all do better and be better. So Diane Cho lived less than a mile from the Cloverleaf Mall, and she spent a lot of time there. So,
and on December 1st, 1987, Susan Tucker, who was 44 years old, was murdered. Susan was a technical writer for the U.S. Forest Service. She was married, but her husband was out of town at the time. Actually, he was out of the country. He was in Wales on a business trip and also to visit his family. They were planning on moving there. Susan spent the Thanksgiving holiday at home. So I said December 1st, 1987. She wasn't murdered on that date. That's the date she was found.
Right.
Her husband had been trying to call her for several days, but had been getting no answer. But he was in Wales. Mm-hmm. There was nothing he could do about it. Mm-hmm. He was kind of freaking out. And neighbors had noticed that a window in her house had been wide open for days. It was cold, and they thought it was unusual, so they checked on her. The front door was unlocked, but they opened it, and it was chained, so they went to the back door, which was also unlocked, but when they opened the door, they knew that something was wrong because there was a smell of decay, so they notified police. They didn't go in.
I'm thinking that this is the husband who was interviewed by the...
Yes. Mr. Tucker, yeah.
Southern Nightmare, yeah. Yep. And chilling, so listen. The house had been ransacked, and it appeared that the intruder had spent some time in the house. Susan was found nude on the bed with her hands tied behind her back, with the rope tied from her hands to around her neck. She was murdered in Arlington, Virginia on or about November 27th, 1987, so she had been dead for several days before she was found. The scene was described as horrific, and because the corpse had been left there for several days, had a terrible smell. There was an unusual amount of semen left at the scene. It is believed that he was masturbating as he was killing Susan Tucker. The killer had entered the home by breaking a basement window, and then broken glass was collected as evidence. They also found some hairs. However, no fingerprints and no shoe prints. Police believe that the perpetrator wore gloves and that he cleaned the area around the basement window to get rid of a shoe print as evidence. Interesting side note is Susan's husband took half of her ashes to Arizona near Sedona, where they lived for a time, and her also took the other half to her family in South America. And I have to add, I think that this was the house that the killer like had a snack after everything. Like there was an orange.
Yeah, yeah, I think so too. Yeah. He ate an orange.
Yeah.
Or they think that he ate an orange. There was like an orange cut in half, and it was cut like right on the table. And all of Susan's friends were like, she would never do that. Mm-hmm. She would not just cut an orange on the table.
Yeah.
She was very meticulous.
She would use a cutting board.
Right. So. And then she wouldn't just leave it there. She would have thrown it away. So they found this orange. So they think he like hung out in the house for a while.
That's kind of what I gathered, and that's what I believe.
Yeah. So Detective Joe Horgas was assigned to the case. He noticed distinct similarities between the Tucker murder and the Ham murder in 1984. These were the two murders in Arlington. However, David Vasquez, if you remember, had already been convicted in the Ham case.
That's
Vasquez
right.
Was a janitor with a low IQ who had confessed to the murder. And I suspect the confession was coerced. After all, this was Virginia in the 80s.
Just saying.
Detective Horgas went to interview Vasquez. And after speaking with him, he felt that Vasquez actually knew nothing about the crime he had been convicted of and that an innocent man was in jail.
Have you ever been to Virginia?
Probably, but I don't remember.
Well, I haven't either. But I Virginia was in the news because they elected somebody who is super liberal recently. Maybe it was a trans person or something.
About that.
Yeah, it might have been at the end of earlier 2018. But there was an interesting comment made about Virginia, how it was Virginia is where our democracy began. And at times it can be super antiquated, super ass backwards, but it is also at the same time can be at the forefront of innovation and democracy. So a lot of new and old ideas in Virginia. And so
interesting.
So I just had to say that. I'll shut up now.
Okay.
Oh, wait, no, it's my turn. Wait.
It's your turn.
Yeah. Oh, okay. So Horgas was convinced that not only was Vasquez innocent, but that the same man who had killed Ham also killed Tucker. Then he came across a teletype alert from Richmond. The alert detailed two recent murders on Richmond's affluent south side, Debbie Davis and Susan Helms. Is it Helms or Hellums? Hellums. Okay. Both women had been raped, strangled with nooses, and left with their hands bound. There were no fingerprints and no witnesses. Horgas believed that all of the murders and the rapes ascribed to the masked rapist were the work of what the press in Richmond were calling the Southside Strangler. Horgas called a detective, Glenn Williams of the Richmond Police. And Williams described a third murder that had occurred on November 21st, just over the Richmond city line. The murder of high school student Diane Cho.
Horgas asked Williams if anything else was happening in Richmond. And Williams mentioned a recent attack in the same neighborhood where Davis and Helms had lived. A black man wearing a mask had entered a woman's apartment through a window and was tying her up when her neighbors heard noises and came to investigate. The man fled and had not been caught. Horgas told Williams about the Arlington murders, but Williams was skeptical of any connection. Arlington was too far away, he said. And according to psychological profiles prepared by FBI experts, serial killers were almost always white.
Oh, that's right. Because why? Because why? Oh boy. Serial killers are always white. Go on, guys. So the Richmond, Virginia community realized that they had a serial killer on the loose. Locks were sold out at hardware stores. Women were even told to nail their windows shut. The killer was dubbed the South Side Strangler. Horgus decided to tap the FBI behavioral unit for help. A profile was done, and the FBI agreed with Horgus that the masked rapist was the same perp who committed the murders. The profile indicated that the perp was 18 to 30 years old, quiet, and a loner, that he probably held a menial job and had a troubled relationship with his mother. They surmised that he may have started with arson. They said he was a sadistic killer who enjoyed making his victims suffer. And the fact that he attacked his victims in their homes suggested that he stalked them first so he would know when to attack.
But the most useful suggestion to Horgus was that they thought that the perp probably lived close to where he committed his first rape. They said that often the first crime will be near where the perpetrator lives because the perp is comfortable with the area and knows all of the places where he can commit the crime unseen, and he would know when the police are in the area, etc. So Horgus concentrated on the first rape, where a woman had been taken from a phone booth in one area and then assaulted in another, a wooded lot in Green
the
Valley.
The FBI also told him that the break in the crimes from 1984 to 1987 was another clue. So Detective Horgus was looking for a man who lived or worked in Green Valley and who was also, or who had also been imprisoned between 1984 to 1987. He started combing through records of parolees to find someone who matched that information. But after going through records for days, he remembered a Green Valley juvenile who he had run-ins with, a young kid with a string of burglary convictions and arson. He remembered him as Timmy. I just think that's funny. Timmy. But he could not recall his last name. However, after sitting on it for a while, he finally remembered Timmy Spencer.
Spencer had been imprisoned from 1984 to 1987. He had been released to a halfway house in Richmond, so he had ties to both Arlington and Richmond. All of the later crimes were committed when Spencer was signed out of the halfway house. Spencer's mother lived less than a mile from the two murder sites in Arlington and only 200 yards from the spot on Oxford Street where the first rape had been committed. Richmond police surveilled Spencer for 2 weeks, but called it off because he did nothing suspicious, although he was observed going to the Cloverleaf Mall and just sitting there watching people, and he would sometimes follow women. If you recall, all three of the Richmond victims had connections to the Cloverleaf Mall.
I am frustrated that didn't he have a job? Like,
he did, but I don't know what it was. That is not something that I could find.
I did not find that information.
Southern Nightmare mentioned that he did have a job, but didn't say what it was.
Well, we are going to be wrapping this up. So finally, a few days after the Richmond police stopped watching Spencer, Horgus presented evidence to a grand jury in Arlington. He and the prosecutor involved, Helen Fahey, Helen Fahey, were afraid that Spencer would strike again when he wasn't being surveilled. And according to Fahey, an arrest warrant could be challenged later in court for lack of probable cause. But grand jury indictments are harder to challenge.
The grand jury came back with an indictment, and Horgus drove to Richmond, where on January 20th at 5:50 p.m., he arrested Spencer at his halfway house on suspicion of burglary. Based on an FBI suggestion, the detective didn't mention the murders or the rapes to Spencer. He hoped to use the drive back to Arlington to get Spencer to talk.
Ooh.
With no hard evidence, remember, all they had was some hairs.
Some Negroid hairs.
And some glass, but They didn't even have anything to compare it with at that time when he was arrested. They had nothing. So with no hard evidence, he knew there was only two ways to prove the case: get Spencer to confess or get him to volunteer a blood sample, which I didn't know. I think now they can take blood samples without their consent.
But if you're under arrest, they can.
We should find
that out.
He was under arrest, but this was a different time. So yeah. Apparently at that time, he would have to agree to it. But I think now they can get some kind of a warrant and get their blood sample. Mm,
yes, that sounds right. I think I heard that on Nancy Grace. By the way, do you watch Nancy Grace?
I think
Grace?
I heard it on... no, I hate Nancy Grace. I hate that bitch.
Oh, my God.
She's another one I want to punch in the face.
She's smelling shit.
Oh, she's such a nasty-ass bitch.
She is really... I could go on for days.
Yeah.
So,
I hate that bitch.
Maybe for some bonus content, we could talk about how we feel about Nancy Grace.
Nancy Grace.
So Spencer didn't say much during the drive, even after Horgus tried to draw him out with news of his old neighborhood in Arlington. And he also remained pretty tight-lipped during the interrogation that followed. The detectives were surprised because he was polite, he spoke well. And all I had to say about the detective who said that on camera was, dude, your racism is showing. You shouldn't say that about black people who talk like you. Anyway.
Although I have to say that in the documentary I saw, the detective who said this, it wasn't Horgus, it was a different detective.
Mm-hmm.
He said that Spencer was articulate and polite, so he actually questioned whether or not they had the right guy. It wasn't that he was surprised that a black guy could speak so articulately. He was like, do we have the right guy? Because okay. He said he found okay. himself thinking that this guy didn't seem like a murderer. And then he would remember the evidence that they had, which is kind of a similar dichotomy with Ted Bundy, where people are like, but he's so nice.
But he's so
you
nice.
Know?
Oh,
yeah. He seems okay. so polite.
He seems so nice. Okay. Whenever I just hear a white person say, that black person or person of color over there is so articulate, I assume they're
very
they're
articulate.
Racist.
and sometimes they are.
Sometimes they but are.
that's how I read it when okay. he was talking.
When you say it like that, okay, down dog, I get it. All right. So by 2 a.m., Horgus was ready to quit. He asked Spencer one last time to submit to a blood test, saying it was needed to compare some blood found on a broken window in a burglary case. To his surprise, Spencer agreed. Horgus was so surprised that he began to wonder if Spencer was actually innocent. However, it is likely that because DNA evidence was so new, Spencer didn't realize that a blood test could be used to match a semen sample. Gotcha, bitch.
While Spencer remained in jail, Horgus boarded a plane to New York carrying Spencer's blood sample to Life Codes. DNA lab, which at this time there were no state DNA labs. This was like one of the only DNA labs. And I think the Richmond police had already sent their samples over. So he brought Spencer's blood sample to that DNA lab. Wow. And he was told that the results would take at least 6 to 10
weeks. Get the fuck out of here.
Yeah. Then he proceeded to call Lisa Bennett, the technician in charge, nearly every single day.
Way to go, Horgus. Horgus and DNA are the heroes of this story. Police also collected blood and hair evidence and searched his room in the halfway house, where they took his clothes, including a jacket. They brushed the clothes and found glass fragments from the jacket, which they compared to the glass from the Tucker crime scene, using glass refraction analysis. This is where, in layman's terms, okay, so now I'll be able to understand, they measure how glass bends light. The glass from his jacket was found to have the same optical characteristics as the glass from the Tucker crime scene, but it was a pretty common glass, not that unusual. So this evidence was not really that helpful.
Yeah, and the hair also was not that helpful.
Don't forget about the Negroid hair. Oh, yeah, but it wasn't
the Negroid hair. The Negroid hair. I mean, they knew it was a black man, but it was consistent with a Negroid.
Oh, God. Oh, my God.
All right. Okay. Moving on.
Sorry.
On March 16th, Lisa Bennett from Life Codes called with the findings. Spencer's DNA matched DNA left at the murders of Susan Tucker, Debbie Davis, and Susan Helms, as well as one of the Arlington rapes that had occurred 4 years earlier.
It was a match! They did it! We are at
the trial.
Oh, I'm Wendy.
Yes, you're Wendy.
I'm Wendy.
That's okay. You.
That's me. Oh, so sorry. So, Jesus. Helen Fahey, the prosecutor in the case, was very nervous about going to trial based on DNA evidence and almost nothing else. Isn't that funny? Because now that's all we need, right?
Yeah, that's DNA was
brand new technology at the time, and she felt that it was asking a lot of a jury to believe this new technology was good enough to convict beyond a reasonable doubt in a capital murder case.
The science was so new that the judge in the case, Benjamin Kendrick, had to hold a special hearing prior to Spencer's court date to determine whether DNA evidence was legally admissible. Really? It was very controversial at the time. Yep. At any time they introduce new technology like that, it's always controversial at the beginning. A lot of people thought of it like junk science. But Judge Kendrick made the decision that it was reliable and it was going to be.
Shout out to Judge Kendrick. Because, by the way, there are a lot of trash ass judges in the United States.
Oh, yeah.
I am glad for Judge Kendrick. Spencer was put on trial for Susan Tucker's murder on September 22nd, 1988. According to one courtroom observer, Spencer would sit quietly until crime scene photos were shown, and at which point he would come to life. Like, I saw that he really wanted to see the pictures. Like, he like salivating over them almost.
Like, very excited when the pictures would be shown.
Kind of like, like when your 5-year-old paints a really good picture and they, like, are excited for you to see it. That's how he was.
Yep. After 6 hours of deliberation, a Richmond jury found Spencer guilty of rape, burglary, and capital murder. The jury unanimously fixed Spencer's punishment at death, which was affirmed on direct appeal.
It was the electric chair that he got, by the way.
Yeah.
Anyway, we'll get to that in a second. In 1988 and 1989, Spencer was tried and convicted of the murders of Davis and Helms in Richmond and Cho in nearby Chesterfield. He was sentenced to death in each case. During the trial, Cho's mother took the stand with the help of a translator because she didn't speak English. She spoke only Korean. And she was really affected by the sight of Spencer. And they were very religious. So she asked to say a prayer prior to her testimony. And then after she testified, she just like lost it and lunged at Spencer. And then I think the power went out in the courthouse.
Yeah. Yeah, during the trial, the power went out and it was dark and people were like freaking out. Yeah.
Yeah, it's this is wild. I don't know why there's not a movie about it. Yeah.
Yeah. Although the DNA from Carol Ham's murder was too degraded to use, it had sat in storage for too long. Horgus pushed for the exoneration of the man previously convicted of her murder, David Vasquez, the Latinx man.
Horgus.
To make a case for Vasquez, the prosecutor, Helen Fahey formally requested the help of the FBI, including Special Agent John Douglas. John Douglas, where's the hip hop air horn?
Oh, John Douglas!
John Douglas, who had founded the FBI's Behavioral Science Unit in the early 1980s. Oh. When Douglas agreed to help Fahey, it was the first time FBI profilers had ever been asked to help prove a suspect
Come
innocent.
On, guys. This is groundbreaking. Why isn't there a movie?
I know. I got involved because one of the things that evolved at that time was linking cases together, Douglas explains. What you look for is a signature. A signature is a ritual.
In the Spencer case, Douglas believed that the unusual cord bindings constituted a unique signature in all five murders. Citing this and other factors, FBI agent Stephen Mardigan drafted a 35-page report along with a letter, which Douglas also signed, asking for Vasquez's pardon. Fahey sent it along with her own pardon petition to the Virginia governor Gerald Baliles. I don't know.
I'm going to say Gerald Baliles.
In October 1988 and on January 4th, 1989, Vasquez was released from prison, the first person in the U.S. to be exonerated, albeit indirectly, by DNA evidence. Woo! That's good news. All right. So, where are they now?
Spencer was executed on April 27th, 1994, by electric chair. He was the first person to be executed based on DNA evidence and the last person in Virginia to be executed by electric chair.
The last person?
The last person.
Oh.
Not to be executed, but to be executed by electric chair. After that, they went to lethal injection.
Maybe I shouldn't ask you this. What do you think about the death penalty?
I am anti-death penalty. Yeah.
Oh, I am so for it, but only if they have the right person.
Well, because, that's the problem.
Oh. So, okay. So
that's
in my mind,
the problem.
In
Yeah, it's not a perfect world. Yeah. There's, as you know, there's so many people who get convicted, and the majority of them are people of color who get convicted erroneously. And
oh boy, this is a hot take alert here.
I think you cannot have a death penalty until
system,
you can
right?
perfect that, and I don't think it can ever be perfected. So I don't. I'm very anti death penalty. Also, one more thing is that rotting in jail, I think, is worse than getting the death penalty. So as long as the person is in jail for life, that there's no possibility of parole, then I'm fine with it. They're out of society. They're not hurting us.
So I think that we should abolish prisons. I don't think that they work.
What?
Yes.
So what do you do with all the criminals then?
Oh, okay. So I don't have an answer for that. I don't. But I don't think that we can continue to keep like building like these private prisons that are run by these.
I don't think we should have private prisons. I think those are terrible.
Yeah, I agree.
The prison system should not be a money-making venture. It's not. That's just a bad idea.
We should take notes from other countries who are doing it right.
What works for other countries. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think especially for this is a really complex subject.
Oh, for sure.
For people and like young no people. Right. Yeah, that's true. Young people and for people who do not commit violent crimes, I think the emphasis should definitely be on rehabilitation.
For sure.
And not in the way that they're doing it now, which is just terrible. Did you read Orange is the New Black, the book?
I did not, but if I can find an audio version of the book, then
you should definitely listen to that, because it talks a lot about the problems with the prison system, and it really made me want to get involved. Like,
oh, that's cool.
To help. There's a lot of these people, like in our last case, growing up in families that are dysfunctional, and they're using drugs, and they just grow up in this terrible environment. They don't know any different, and they end up in jail because they're doing drugs or whatever, and the prison system actually makes their life worse.
And that's not what their family's life worth, and it's not what they need, and it's not helping anything, it's not
helping society. It's not helping them. It's not helping their families. So, I mean, I think an overhaul is definitely in
order. Yeah, for sure. I mean, do you remember that scene in Orange is the New Black where there was a girl who was delivering a baby and they had her chained to a bed?
And that's,
it's on TV, but that happens every fucking day. So, yeah, we've got it wrong and we need to try to do it right. So, that's where I'm coming from with abolishing prisons and getting rid of police. Anyway, another hot take.
Yeah. Hot take. Woo, 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 woo. So where the hell? Oh, he was executed. Yeah. Okay. We're at the end. What made him snap?
Oh, yes. What made him snap? Well, from what I gather, he was a controlling individual. Like, I remember that snippet from his brother on the YouTube documentary where his little brother tried to do something bad just like him, and he was like, no, bro, don't be like me. So he was controlling. He clearly had some anger towards women. Spencer had a pattern of escalation. He would break into homes, then he would defecate in the homes, then he would steal things. I don't even understand. Just, I am going to poop in your house.
It's an expression of dominance. You know, I'm gonna break into your house and then I'm gonna crap on it.
Then I'm literally gonna shit on all your stuff.
Yes, I am gonna shit on your stuff. Yeah. So he's violating their boundaries and he is expressing his dominance.
Okay.
So
Then I'm gonna try that tomorrow. Anyway.
I'm gonna go to work and crap on my boss's desk.
My kids do it all the time, so
it's very childish when you think about it. You know, it is a very childish thing to do.
My daughter pooped in the backyard the other day because she thought it was all right. So, and it wasn't.
But she's three, so.
So she's not in her 30s like Mr. Spencer. So he would steal things, and then he would start. So this is how the escalation happened. He would trespass against people's things, and then eventually against people, and that led to rape and murder. And I also think some narcissistic personality disorder might be at play here. He was very handsome and fit, and he had those hazel eyes. There's a famous rapper. His name's Eric Sermon, and they call him the green-eyed bandit because his eyes are so beautiful.
So pretty.
Anyway, yeah. So, and I think people who are attractive tend to have these like expectations about how people should respond to them. And
yeah, they're used to people responding to them in a certain way. And when they don't,
right,
they get angry. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, and you, the true crime OG, would know way more about this whole narcissistic bullshit than I would. But I just know that all of the attractive people I know are not always very nice. So since he was a narcissist, it makes sense that he would prey and torture on women for his own ego gratification. So,
and going back to antisocial personality disorder, which we talked about last week. Uh-huh. Pretty darn sure this guy had it.
I think so.
On the far, far end. He had a history of criminal behavior starting at a young age, a lack of empathy, and he was a sexual sadist. A psychologist on one of the documentaries I watched labeled him as a predatory psychopath and said that there may be a genetic component. That he may have been hardwired that way. And I've heard this before, that there's a genetic component, and there's some controversy over what they call it, a psychopath gene. So I'm reading up on that.
Let me know what you find.
It's controversial. Yeah. So Dr. Michael Stone, who's a forensic psychiatrist, suggested that some serial killers may have deficits in the amygdala or prefrontal cortex of the brain from birth, or as we discussed last week, they may have suffered a brain injury. And looking at Spencer's early life, it doesn't seem to me like he had a bad childhood.
No.
At least according to his brother, they had a pretty good childhood. I don't know where the anger towards women came from, unless it was anger towards his mother as being the head of the household and that she had the control in the house, and maybe he resented that. But there could be other factors that we don't know about, like maybe his brother wasn't completely honest about what went on in the house, but it could just be that it could be genetic. I don't know.
Yeah, it could. Yeah. I think you're right. I think, what's troubling, you know, we love true crime, and, one of the reasons why I love it is because, so I know I'm informed about who could be really crazy, what terrible things could happen, what should I do to be safe? And this is particularly scary because we have no idea why he did what he did or what made him snap. I mean, something could have even happened to him.
Yeah, he didn't talk about it.
Yeah, when he was in prison. Yeah. I mean, he could have got fucked up in prison. You know, I don't know. I don't know. He could have gotten... It really is a mystery, and that is what is so terrifying.
Yeah.
But let's get into our takeaways, Beth. So what did this episode mean to you? I'll start. I think that DNA is fucking awesome, and I'm going to get my next tattoo is going to be DNA. My next child is gonna be DNA Williams, because DNA is so amazing. This is the first case where DNA evidence was used to confirm and convict a murderer ever. At the time Spencer's death
in the U.S.
or in the U.S. Okay, sorry.
Right.
Spencer's defense attorneys took the position that this DNA is. It's all we have. Oh my God. It's just DNA. Like they were, they had a really minimalist approach to DNA. Like they didn't realize how fucking dope DNA is and how accurate it is. And they didn't think it was trustworthy. And at the time, it was so new that they hoped that the jury wouldn't buy it or wouldn't find it valid. But I think I saw in that documentary that we have shouted out numerous times throughout the show that his own defense attorneys sent the DNA evidence to another lab and it came back.
A private lab,
yeah. And it identified Spencer and they're like, oh. Maybe DNA stuff is real.
So yeah, and I remember one of the lawyers said that he wore like hot pink socks in court.
Oh yeah, to distract the jury.
To distract the jury while they were giving the evidence.
I thought that was pretty wild.
They were doing whatever they could. Yeah.
Whatever you can to get your, you know, to get your client off. And I'm assuming he had a public defender, but I don't know. So
yeah, I don't know either. Yeah.
But DNA doesn't lie. DNA is my hero, and I will ride or die for DNA every fucking day of the week. Okay, bitch. Okay. What do you think?
Yeah, so I was really interested in the forensics in this case. Not only the DNA, which was really interesting, but also the glass and the hair, which I didn't really know much about. So
the glass.
So that was pretty interesting. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was also really impressed by the investigation by Detective Horgus, although Susan Tucker's husband remembers him as kind of an asshole who suspected him. But Horgus denies that he ever suspected him. But in any case, he was the first to connect the murders to the masked rapist. And he realized that Vasquez was not guilty. He took the time to interview Vasquez, to talk to police in another jurisdiction, which, you know, they don't always do, and to consult with the FBI. He was also the one who connected Spencer, because he remembered him. He had a dogged persistence. His fellow detectives described him as being aggressive and intense and difficult to work with. So that might be why Susan Tucker's husband thought he was an asshole.
You either loved him or you hated him is what I heard.
Right, so. Right. Nothing in between.
Nope.
But he was the one who pushed for Vasquez's exoneration. Even though there was no DNA evidence left to exonerate him, he didn't have to do that. He could have just forgot about it, but he pushed for it. He really worked for it. And as an aside, I read that Horgus never would have found Spencer's name in the records of parolees that he was combing to find a suspect when, after he talked to the FBI and they said, you know, look for somebody who was jailed during this time. He never would have found him because convicts released to halfway houses at the time were not technically considered paroled. He found him because he remembered him somehow. The name just popped in his head.
Timmy.
In any case, yeah, Timmy. I have to say, I don't know about you, Wendy. Out of all of the cases we've covered so far, I think Timothy Wilson Spencer is the worst.
How come you say that?
Well, going back to Michael Stone, the forensic psychiatrist that I mentioned earlier, he created a scale of evil, which is also featured on the TV show Most Evil. Have you ever seen that?
I feel like I really need to.
I think it's probably on the ID channel.
Okay.
He talks about different people and where they fall on his scale of evil. So in my opinion, Spencer rates the highest on Stone's scale of evil at 22. Oh. That's the highest. Psychopathic torture murderer. According to Stone, more than 90% of serial killers are psychopaths and sadists, but what drives them to kill varies from person to person. Some of them are loners and capable of sustained romantic relationships, and they'll rape women and then kill them to destroy the evidence. like a one night stand, but with murder at the end. others
want to Netflix and chill and die.
And die. Netflix and die.
Netflix and die. Ooh.
Others are seeking revenge, although the real source of their anger, which is usually apparent, is projected onto their victims. So they're thinking about somebody else in their life, and they kill the victim as a proxy.
Right.
But as far as Spencer is concerned, what got him off and what motivated him was inflicting prolonged torture. And he really loved it. And
yeah, he would mess with these women for hours.
Yeah. And he would strangle them until they passed out, and then bring them back and strangle them again, because it made him feel in control. And he wanted that to go on for a long time.
Yeah.
And it's so sick. It really disturbed me. And
yeah. So I love true crime, and you do too. But
yes.
Some things really get me and or get to me, or and it's torture against children and just mm-hmm. prolonged torture against women, and I watched a YouTube video of a cyst being exploded, and it was just like a ugh. So that's the feeling.
That's the feeling you get.
That's the feeling. Like I had to like get up and jump around and run around. That's the feeling that it gives me. Like it's just really uncomfortable. So
it is. It is.
I don't know why I'm laughing. Oh, because I'm uncomfortable. That's why.
Yeah. It's something women do.
Yeah, sorry. This is what
laugh
I do
when we're uncomfortable.
We're nervous. Yeah, it's so funny. Okay.
It's so funny. It's not funny.
It's not funny, but okay. If you love true crime and you don't want to die, here's a tip for you.
This segment is not intended to be victim blaming. We thought of this segment because I read somewhere that a lot of people listen to true crime because they want to know what they can do to be safer. But in my mind, this is not meant to blame the victims. It's just learning from other people's mistakes. Sometimes we have no suggestions for a particular episode, and we'll just offer up generic tips. So take it away,
for
Wendy.
For example. So Dr. Helms was aware that there was a serial rapist. And shortly before she died, remember, Dr. Helms was the neurosurgery resident. Before she died, the whole town was like, this is fucking scary. And one of her colleagues reported that they walked out of the hospital together shortly before she died. I think it was the day before, together for safety, like the buddy system. And unfortunately, when she got home, Spencer was there waiting for her. And I'm thinking, like, is it a good idea? We got to trust our intuition, ladies. And if you notice anything out of place in your home after you walk into the door, maybe you could grab a neighbor, grab a friend. Do you have a dog or a broom to like arm yourself with? But I don't think it sounded like Ms. Helms got into her home. Everything must have looked normal to her. And she was about to turn in for the night, right? And that's when he attacked. And
right.
Me, I like to check the whole house before I relax. I let in all the dogs. Everybody goes through the house. I check I check everything. Is anything out of place? And that's just me because I'm a true crimer and I know that anybody could die at any time. And so that's my recommendation, is check everything before you sit down and relax and watch your, or before you sit down and listen to this podcast when you're at home.
So. Yeah, that's a good idea. I never really even thought about that, to be honest.
Yeah.
And this is another case where the perpetrator came in through windows. So again, it's a good idea to lock and check your windows and doors. Keep your inner doors locked too, like the door to the basement or the garage. In a couple of the cases, he gained entry through a basement window. What freaks me out the most is that he would hide in the house, like in the closet and wait.
Yeah.
That totally freaks me out.
Yeah.
So like you said, scan the house when you come home. See if anything looks out of place. Look at the windows. Make sure they're not broken or the screen's not cut, or, you know, don't leave them open so there's no question about the screen.
Yeah. And this was also in the 80s, right? So not a lot of people probably had security systems. Now we do. Right?
Yeah.
So, times are a little bit different. We are a little bit more evolved and a little bit safer because of it. But I don't think you should relax until you know it's okay to relax.
Right.
That's it for the, what's this guy's name?
Timothy Wilson Spencer.
AKA the Southside Strangler. Okie dokie. We've got mail.
Yay!
We had a listener in our discussion group on Facebook, and Val, thank you for the nice message. She said, great podcast, excellent details, flow, and commentary. I love getting their perspective on the crimes and the criminals and how they relate to the bigger picture of culture, prejudices, and racism. Yay! Thanks for the nice note, Val.
Yes, thank you.
And another listener in our group, Karen, says that she now pays attention to these stories more since she started listening to the podcast. So that's great. All we want to do is spread the word because nobody knows about this stuff.
Yeah, I think that's pretty cool, I think.
Thank you, Karen and Val. We love you. So, hey, Beth, where can they find us?
Well, they can find us at our website, which is fruitloopspod.com. Mm. Our Facebook page is Fruit Loops Pod, and our discussion group is Fruit Loops Pod Discussion. We are also on Twitter and Instagram at Fruit Loops Pod. Also, links to our sources will be in our footnotes. If you want to support the show, you can send us a donation on the Cash app, which is cash.me/$FruitloopsPod. This will help us pay for things like our website and pod hosting. There's no minimum. Even a dollar would help.
That's right. So thank you for sticking with us. This is a weekly podcast and new episodes drop every Thursday. So until next time, look alive, guys. It's crazy out there.